It's to the best of our knowledge. Cult filmmaker John Waters has been called the Pope of Filth and the King of Trash. His films like Polyester and the cult classic Pink Flamingos have, to put it mildly, transgressed the boundaries of good taste. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, pushing the limits of film with John Waters. We'll also talk with the infamous Winnebago Man, known as the angriest man on YouTube, and the makers of Ed Gein the Musical. Yes, a musical comedy about Ed Gein, the serial killer. First, the news. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We love the movies. For a good cry or a good scare. For a laugh, or just to escape life for 90 minutes. But sometimes they do a little more. A film can push society's limits. Think Birth of a Nation, or Last Tango in Paris, or even The Last Temptation of Christ. A movie can also push technological limits and expand how and what we see. Think of the time-bending special effects of The Matrix, or the 3D wonder of Avatar. But then again, a film can push the limits by just being a good old-fashioned piece of trash. Enter stage left, John Waters. He's been called the Pope of Filth and the King of Trash. Love him or hate him, John Waters put bad taste on the map with his outrageous 1972 film Pink Flamingos, starring the drag queen from hell, Divine. His equally audacious 1981 film Polyester cemented his status as a cult hero. His movie Hairspray was turned into a smash hit on Broadway, earning over $200 million and winning 8 Tony Awards. But John Waters' latest project? It's not a film. It's a book. A book about the people who've influenced his life. It's called Role Models. Now, as you can imagine, the book is full of folks like a lesbian stripper named Lady Zorro, and Charles Manson accomplice Leslie Van Houten. But one name jumped out at Steve Paulson. Johnny Mathis. Johnny Mathis?
Well, he was the first makeout party I ever went to. They played his music, and I firmly believe that Johnny Mathis still makes all of America want to make out. And nobody's brought that up as a possible thing to do on Inauguration Day. Maybe Johnny Mathis should have sang, and everybody in America started making out. Wouldn't that be maybe a new way to bring the completely different sides and political ideas and theories together? You can make out with somebody you don't believe in politically, because then they can't talk.
Johnny Mathis as the healer of our nation.
I think he could be.
So what was it like when you finally met Johnny Mathis?
He was lovely. I think they were a little nervous. It was hard to reach Johnny Mathis because Johnny Mathis doesn't do publicity. You've never seen him at a red carpet. You never see him in columns. He doesn't go to those things. And he's just told me he just wants to be a great singer. That's it. So when I finally got there, I noticed his lawyer was there, which made me a little nervous. But I said, would you Google me? And they said, well, yeah. And I get why they were nervous. I'd be nervous if I was Johnny Mathis and I was in his house too. He was lovely. And Johnny and I, John is what everybody calls him. I call him Mr. Mathis. We got along very nicely. He was a very kind man, very warm man, and the lawyer left soon. He was very nice, too.
Yeah. Okay. So that was a success, meeting.
Well, I think it was. But even in his house, he certainly, you know, I knew that he was Republican, and Nancy Reagan came over and sang Christmas carols with him. And then I thought, well, Patricia Hearst came to my house, and we plotted hair color for a trial appearance. So it's all the same. It's just different. You know, I always joke that I voted for Obama because he was a friend of Bill Ayers.
It's not for me to say you love me. it's not for me to say. You'll always care.
Johnny Mathis is clearly the exception in your gallery of role models. Most are transgressive figures, and one you read about early in the book is the actress Patty McCormick, who as an 11-year-old played the young killer, was it Rhonda in...
Rhoda Penmark
Rhoda,
in The Bad Seed.
In the
Bad
Seed.
Pigtailed girl. But, you know, she is not transgressive. She's a lovely woman, a really good actress. She's still acting. She played Pat Nixon in Nixon Frost. She's unfacelift. She's pretty. She's nice. She's smart. She's witty. I don't think anybody in this book I write about ironically. I'm really amazed by all the people in this book for the right reasons, even though they might have had extreme things in their lives. That's how I'm wondering, how did a little girl that played a murderess for several years on Broadway every night and then in the movie and has to talk about that role for the rest of her life, how did she turn out to be so well-adjusted?
Well, tell me about your fascination with that character, Rhoda, in The Bad Seed. Because you say that as a kid, it just sort of, you found her kind of wondrous.
Yes. I wanted to be Rhoda Penmark. I used to go through grade school and shout in my mind out to the stupid students who had no idea what it was. The Bad Seed is the big shocker. That was the ad campaign. And I wanted to sit in the little pink electric chair they were supposed to give her in the movie with her. I wanted to be feared like Rhoda. And so Rhoda was, she was my imaginary friend when I was a kid. Other people maybe liked Robin Hood or Batman, but I liked little Rhoda Penmark. She was my secret friend.
Give me those shoes back.
Oh, no, I got them shoes hid where no bottom of me can find them.
You better give me those shoes. They're mine. Give them back to me.
I ain't giving them shoes back to nobody.
You'd better give them back to me, Leroy.
I'm keeping them shoes. Who says I got anybody's shoes except my own?
You did. You get them and give them back.
I'm fooling you. I'm teasing you. I got nobody's shoes. I got work to do.
Give me back my shoes.
I got nobody's shoes. Don't you know what anybody's teasing you?
You bring them back.
Play with your puzzle. I got no shoes. I keep telling you.
You bring them back.
I believe he did it. I was fooling before, but now I believe you kill him.
You're killing a little boy with his shoes.
I want to step back for a moment and get at why you were so fascinated by the Manson murders early on. I mean, to the point where you actually went and attended the trial.
I did, and made a movie about it. Right after I went to the Manson trial, I made Pink Flamingos, and I think that, I guess they were the filthiest people alive. It was in the 60s, your parents said, if you take LSD, you're going to end up a crazy killer hippie. Well, they were. I took LSD, and I never had a bad experience, and my mother always says, don't tell young people that. And if I had a kid today and they were taking LSD, I'd be nervous. But I didn't have a bad experience. But they went through a period under his power where they purposely tried to never come down. And you can reach a point. I mean, the girls thought they were elves. I mean, this is really beyond what you could possibly imagine. I can't imagine it. But in the beginning, I used it in a smart-ass, jokey way. And in my early movies, I dedicated the movies to the Manson girls. And that was kind of like a punk rock, smart-ass thing to do. And I do regret that in a way.
So how do you look back on your films that sort of touched on or drew inspiration from all of that?
Movies like Multiple Maniacs and Pink Flamingos were made to scare hippies. They were punk rock movies before I never heard of punk rock. There was no such thing as punk rock, but they played to hippie audiences. But we were trying to make a movie that startled people that were pretty hard to startle in those years, the late 60s and the early 70s. So I look back on those movies. I'm proud of those movies. They still work. The day I die, no matter what, Pink Flamingos will be in the first paragraph of my obituary, I promise you.
Divine, are you a lesbian?
Yes, I have done everything.
Does blood turn you on?
I love the taste of it, the taste of hot, freshly killed blood.
Could you give us some of your political beliefs?
Kill everyone now. Condone first-degree murder. Advocate cannibalism. Filth are my politics. Filth is my life. Take whatever you like.
Now, you have often made a point of seeking out people you have admired.
Yes.
I guess I wonder, are there certain role models that you wish you had not met?
No, there's one chapter in my book where it didn't turn out so well with Little Richard, somebody who I've loved since I was 8 years old and first heard him and thought, my God, you know, they called Little Richard flamboyant then, which was a code word. But even when I was 8 years old, I know this, he was like a Martian. He was so great. I mean, he and Elvis, they did invent rock and roll. So he liberated me. I still wear Little Richard's mustache that I appropriated from him when I was very young. And so I finally went to meet him, but it was difficult because he had written a book where he described amazing things like mailing bowel movements to his enemies in a gift wrap box. And I thought, we did that too in Pink Flamingos. But he got nervous when I would bring this stuff up because he worried about his religious followers, because he's religious sometimes too. But I was interviewing for Playboy. It wasn't like I was coming from the Christian Science Monitor. Then he told me he was Jewish. So I don't know.
The girl can't help it. She was born to please.
Can't help it. The girl can't help it.
And if she's got figure made to squeeze.
She can't help it. The girl can't help it.
Well, won't you kindly be aware? The girl can't help it.
The girl can't help it.
It's mesmerizing.
Now, you're famous, of course, for, I guess you could say, celebrating filth. You've been called the Pope of Trash. Do you embrace those labels, or...?
Certainly. I mean, I've been milking that one for too long. William Burroughs called me that, though, so how could you forget that? I've been called the Duke of Dirt, the Anal Ambassador. I could give you 100, but I don't want them on my tombstone. I just want my name on my tombstone, because eternity is too long for a joke. Humor dates.
So I have to ask, is there a movie that you've always wanted to make but you've never gotten around to?
Well, yeah, the one I can't get made right now called Fruitcake, which is a terribly wonderful children's Christmas adventure about a very happy family, functional family of meat thieves in Baltimore, and they have a little kid named Fruitcake. And they're stealing shop. The meat men in Baltimore, they come and knock on your door and you say, yeah, I'll take 2 pounds of ground beef and a ham. And then they shoplift it and you pay them half price. It's the normal thing. They come knock on the door, meat man, meat man. And it's about a very happy family of meat thieves.
Good luck. I would like to see that.
Thank you.
Filmmaker John Waters on his book Role Models. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Coming up, a film that would make John Waters proud, Ed Gein, the Musical. Yep, a musical comedy about Ed Gein, the serial killer.
In a lot of his interviews, he talked about dancing in the light of the moon with these dead corpses. So in order to dance, you have to have music. So Ed Gein, the Musical.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
If there's ever been a man who captured the dark heart of Hollywood, it's Ed Gein. He was a notorious Wisconsin killer and grave robber in the late 1950s who made keepsakes and furniture out of women's body parts. Many films have been inspired by Ed Gein, including Psycho, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Silence of the Lambs. But there's never been a film quite like this one. Ed Gein, the musical. Yes, the musical. Steve Paulson sat down with Dan Davies, who wrote the film and plays the role of Ed Gein.
There's a very basic question here. Why make a musical about the serial killer, Ed Gein?
Well, you know, Steve, why not? That's my response. But, you know,
because it's an offensive subject?
Well, you know, for so many years, the genre of musicals have been about matchmakers and young love and state fairs and all these beautiful transcendent things. And then you get Sweeney Todd, which is obviously loosely based on a serial killer from London in the 1880s. And you get The Producers, which is originally entitled Springtime for Hitler. So for me, I thought, this isn't a sacred cow, this genre. This genre should be pushed to the limit. And I thought, why not do a musical on someone who was inherently depraved, like Ed Gein was? Another thing, too, in a lot of his interviews, he talked about dancing in the light of the moon with these dead corpses. So in order to dance, you have to have music. Ed Gein the musical.
Lampshades on lamppost and skin chairs for sitting. Bright human skull bowls and warm flesh-lined mittens. Brown paper packages with fingers and rings. These are a few of my demented things.
Let's get to this question of exploitation, because I think a lot of people would say that's precisely what you did, is you exploited the story. And, I mean, we should talk a little bit about how you did the movie. I mean, it's a portrait of Ed Gein, this incredibly famous killer, but it's a musical. It's a musical comedy, in fact.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you, Steve. It is somewhat exploitative. But when people see our film, we try to make it as a psychological treatise. And I know a lot of times when people can't deal with the strangeness or the macabre things, they use dark or gallows humor. So I thought, let's put gallows or dark humor into it. And also, too, I thought it is exploitative. I mean, obviously, we could have called it something else.
Well sure. I mean, sure. Calling a movie Ed Gein the Musical,
yeah.
I mean, right there.
Yeah.
That's going to get people's attention.
Well, the weirdest thing about this, Steve, was when the AP picked it up, it literally ended up being in over 1,000 publications worldwide via internet and newspaper and magazines. We literally got death threats and threats of mutilation from almost all 50 states, from as far as London and Hong Kong. They hated us for doing this.
What kinds of things did people say in these threats?
The best one, Steve, was directed towards our director, Steve Russell. It said, "Dear Mr. Director, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You are disgusting. How in the world could you do a musical about this disgusting, depraved maniac? You know what I'd like to do to you, Mr. Director? I'd like to cut your arms off. And then I'd like to cut your legs off. And then I'd like to put a hook in your lifeless, legless body. And then I'd like to drag you around through the mud behind my 4x4. And then I'd like to hose you off." Now, hopefully he meant with a garden hose. "And then I'd like to take your armless, legless, lifeless body and feed it to my dogs." And this is how he ended it. He said, "Have a nice day and God bless."
"Look at me waltzing with the dead."
When we're traveling with a film, especially in Wisconsin, we get the best Ed Gein stories. Now, most of them are apocryphal. Most of them are just myth-laden. Because if we had a dollar for every time someone said, "He dug up my grandma, you know, hey, why are you guys doing this film? He dug up my grandma, and then he fed my grandma to my cousins." It's like, come on. And in reality, he had given a list of 8 names to the sheriff, who was my grandfather's friend, and they dug up 2 of those graves and found out the graves were empty, and they didn't have to do anything further. Now, nobody knows, for obvious reasons, the names on that list. Now, my grandfather's friend, the sheriff, knew, and maybe a few of the deputies, but they took that to their grave. It's a lose-lose situation. It's like you're in Plainfield and you come up to one of your buddies and like, hey, Bob, how you doing? Oh, good. Bob, I got good news and bad news. What's the good news? Your grandma made a hell of a chili. Oh, thank you. Well, what's the bad news? She was in it. Wow. You know, I mean, that's a thing. I mean,
this is one of the stories about Ed Gein. He apparently served chili to some of his friends.
Yep.
With the victims in the chili. In fact, there's a story that he may have even won a chili cook-off.
That's a little apocryphal, although his venison sausages were close to award-winning, and he would give them to people. Now, venison is deer, you know, meat. But later on, when he was at the Mendota Mental Health Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, he said he never shot a deer. So you have to make the inference, well, if he didn't get this from deer, where did he get it from? But that's another one of those things. And they said his venison sausage was great. His chili was awesome. And you'd always say, it's venison chili. It's venison chili. And then they'd ask, well, where's your deer? Oh, I didn't get one this year. Never gotten one.
I don't bless my soul, something's wrong with me. I'm cooking like a man on a killing spree. My mom says I'm dating weird like a thug. I'm in love, 'cause she's all cooked up. Uh-huh. Yeah, 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 yeah. Her hands are tasty and her knees are sweet. Her pituitary gland is a tasty treat. Who do you turn to when you need to sup? I'm in love, 'cause she's all cooked up.
When you were making this film and when you were writing the film, did you worry about being too offensive, going too far?
You know, in film, I think if you start doing that from the get-go, you've lost. You have to push the envelope right from the beginning, and then you can always recede it a little bit. Our movie is a little different, too. We made a movie that is not gratuitously violent. There's some violence. Most of it's implied. There's not a swear word in it, and there's no nudity. So, I mean, when's the last time you went to a horror film and didn't see a combination of all three or, you know, all three?
Let's talk for a moment about what can make a film offensive. Because, I mean, it's interesting to think about this and to draw some comparisons. For instance, I mean, a lot of people obviously say your film is gratuitous, salacious, you know, it has gone too far. Let's think about some of the other films that have been based on the Ed Gein story. The Texas Chainsaw Massacres, Psycho, Motel Hell. Can we compare degrees of offensiveness here?
I think nowadays the only thing that could be construed as offensive, we're so inured to the gratuitous, the violence, the arms getting chopped off, the head getting blown up, you know, all the Saw movies. We're kind of inured to that, and that's not offensive to us anymore. There are a couple of lines, though, that I don't think you ever cross. Number one, you don't hurt little kids. You don't hurt little puppies, little dogs. Thirdly, we can't be racist or bigoted. That's another thing. And fourthly, I think our religious sensibilities. You don't want to hurt people's faith and the things that literally make them who they are. So there are limits.
But you're also making – I don't know if making fun is the right word – making humor out of this horror that still directly, presumably, affects people who live in a certain part of Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's true. I guess there aren't that – I hate to say this. I mean, if I offend five people in Plainfield, that's still five too many. But I'll be honest with you. If there are five people 55 years later that are still affected by it, I feel bad for them and I feel sad for them. But it is a minority, very small amount of people. Not to say – I'm not excusing myself. We've got to do that. Springtime for Hitler was literally only 25 years after, you know, and it was done by Mel Brooks, a solid Jewish American who was, you know, no, we have to make fun of these things. We have to poke fun at these things. That's the only way sometimes we can wrap our heads around these things. And for me, that's the way that I think it has to be cathartic, I think, somehow. Unless Plainfield can have the next Oprah or have the next president being born there, they're always going to be the home of Ed Gein. And, you know, to misquote an ex-president, I feel your pain, Plainfield.
You'll be my baby. I'm the guy who likes some breathing.
Olivia, be my lady.
I'll be nothing but a lady.
Death, be my lady tonight.
Yeah. Dan Davies is the writer and lead actor of Ed Gein the Musical. Steve Paulson spoke with him. And now, from Ed Gein to the YouTube sensation, the angriest man in the world.
The Winnebago Concepts and Engineering Departments have developed a multifunctional bathroom privacy I don't even I'm reading. I wonder what the the real dialogue is. All of the windshield for sake. Oh, what the did I say? That didn't sound for did it? Trying to give these guys everything they can get to me. That's it. Oh, don't slam the f***ing door. No more.
Just a sampling of the YouTube sensation dubbed the angriest man in the world, or in kinder terms, the Winnebago man. Named because these rantings come from the outtakes of a 1980s Winnebago industrial film. It only runs about 3 minutes, but this YouTube video has been seen by over 20 million people. One of those viewers was a young man named Ben Steinbauer. Ben found the video so mesmerizing that he decided to find the angriest man in the world and make a film about him. Enter Jack Rebney, the now 81-year-old Winnebago man, living as a hermit in California. And Strange Champ spoke with Ben and Jack after the release of Ben's film, called simply The Winnebago Man. So why did he make this film? Ben says you have to look to another YouTube sensation first. Maybe the greatest YouTube sensation of them all, the Star Wars kid.
It's a clip of a 15-year-old student in Canada who films himself at his high school swinging this golf ball retriever as if he were in the movie Star Wars. And he's going at it with this sort of reckless abandon that is just hilarious, but also very touching. And so he leaves this piece of footage in his school's camera, and some friends, I guess, in quotes, some classmates of his, discover the tape and they post it online, and it just catches fire. Millions of people see it all over. It's on the Colbert Report. It kind of becomes this phenomenon. And as a result, this poor boy had to go into psychiatric care. I mean, he literally had a breakdown as a result of this exposure. And I was watching this case just fascinated with the idea that we now have these sort of digital reputations that we can't live down. For example, no matter what that poor boy goes on to do with his life, he will forever be known as the Star Wars kid.
And so is that the point at which you began wondering about Jack himself and what effect his sudden YouTube sensation was doing to him?
Yeah, so around that time, I start to think, wow, you know, I wonder what the star of my favorite one of these clips, I wonder how he's dealing with this same type of notoriety. And so I started to do this very basic research, and it very quickly became like trying to find Bigfoot, where there were sort of these rumored sightings, and people were sort of talking in hushed, reverent tones about meeting this person 20 years ago, but they've never seen him since, and that set me on my way.
Jack, am I right that your life had long since moved on? I mean, the Winnebago video project from which the outtakes came was a very small chapter that you must have felt you'd long ago put behind you.
You used the term chapter. It wasn't a chapter. It was a phrase. It was the work of a moment. It was nothing. And the interesting part in regard to what Ben has said and the intimation, whatever happened to this guy, whatever happened to me, was that I never gave it a second thought. It never, ever occurred to me. I got a call from a friend of mine, and he said, have you pulled yourself up on the Internet lately? And I said, what for? What do I care? What, I'm going to look at somebody that with a broken arm? It's irrelevant to me. And he said, well, you got to do this. And I said, okay. And so I did. And here I am, using this incredible array of Anglo-Saxonese terminology, which has become my standard, as it were. And I talked to him, and I said, where did this come? What is this? This is crazy. This is insane. Well, it finally dawned on me, and of course the story is as simple as it is on its face. These sweet little people down at the editing booths of where we did the edit on those marketing videos concluded that what they would do is they would take the outtakes, put them together, and they would have something that they could have fun with. There you are. That's it. Never, ever thought of it. Completely irrelevant to me.
I want to talk a bit about the relationship between the two of you. Ben, it took quite a bit of work and dedication for you to track Jack down in the first place, so you must have built him up in your mind quite a bit. Was he like what you were expecting?
No, not at all. And for those of you who haven't seen the movie, that's one of the bigger story beats at the very beginning, is that it takes me a long time. I have to end up hiring a private investigator, actually, to find Mr. Rebney, because it turns out he's a hermit living on top of a mountain in Northern California, where he's been effectively off the grid for, what, Jack, about 15 years?
Yeah, about.
Yeah, and so I had to track him down, and it took a really long time. So when I did finally go meet him, he presented this very staid and very balanced and calm persona, and I was amazed. I just thought, wow, this guy has, you know, seclusion has been very good to him. He's up here clearly meditating and, you know, reading the, you know, throwing the I Ching and, you know, communing with the stars or something and just being very relaxed.
Jack, what about that vibe? Because you do come across in that first meeting as this very mellow mountain man with a Zen vibe. You later called Ben up and told him that was all an act. Was it?
Well, yes, because here's this young man who comes walking in with the equipped with all of his cameras and his crew and what have you, and he has the audacity to think that he's going to make this film in regard to me. And, of course, the first thing that I do is look back at history, and I say to myself, okay, categorize this kid. Where's he going? What has he got in his mind? How is this all going to pan out? What can I do to have it become something that I might wish it to be? And obviously then what I'm going to do is I'm going to play Mary Poppins for him till I understand where he's going, what he really has in mind. And upon finding that, then it comes to me, of course, okay, fine. If the kid really wants to do this, then let's get down to hard cases. I'm not Mary Poppins. I'm Genghis Khan.
Well, so were you concerned that here's this kid coming to invade your life and that, in fact, he wants to use you? He wants to use this, you know, negligible moment in your life to make a film?
When you get into the film, if you remember correctly, ultimately somebody says something and lights my fire. And what do I tell them? I tell them, hey, if you don't like it, pack up and get out.
There were a few
so
other words in there.
Using
that's the censored version, yeah.
That's the public radio version.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's it. You got it. No, I didn't feel used. I didn't feel abused. I didn't feel anyone was taking advantage of me because there was no advantage to be had. If whomever was watching this actually began to get down to the hard cases. And Ben struck on it just a moment ago. It is that viewer, ultimately, always. We have been, I don't know how many theaters that we've been in and had the people come by, and there's some of them are laughing, some of them are crying, but every one of them comes up to you and says, boy, is that honest. That's us, isn't it? That is really where we are as a group, as a people. And it is. And because nobody's trying to shuck and jive anybody. All it is what happened. And that to me, of course, is the brilliance that Ben showed in being able to put together a film where he knew that what he had was all he had to do was take the cap off the camera and say, gosh, let's do something.
You were talking about the kind of memes that run through the film. I guess I'm wondering, What do you want viewers to come away from the film thinking about? Is one of the things you want people to think about the story of generational rapprochement?
Well, I think I would, and I did not have this in mind as I was making the film, but now that we've been showing it around the world for the last year and a half, I think one of the maybe universal things about the film is that, you know, we all have these new ways to communicate suddenly. YouTube is less than 6 years old, and we have things like Facebook and Twitter that are fundamentally changing the way that we communicate. And while it's incredibly exciting that we can all network and know what people are doing on any given moment, you know, across any and multiple platforms, this technology that was designed to bring us together is in effect physically keeping us apart in front of our computers and on our phones. And I think one of the things that people respond to in this story is that this is a clip that you sort of get to walk into, so to speak. You break the fourth wall and go beyond the just seeing this on a computer screen or knowing this person from a 3-minute outtakes clip to really having a relationship with this person and going and physically befriending them. So, I mean, it sounds highfalutin to say that I hope that this new technology does enable more of these type of relationships. And I certainly, that was not my agenda in making the film, but you know, that's what's happened as a result. And we sort of, my producing team and I laughingly refer to the film now as a cross between Tuesdays with Maury and My Dad Says, right? And it really has become this sort of like this kind of mentor relationship. And I'm so gratified to say that I have an 81-year-old blind hermit on speed dial as a great friend of mine as a result of making the film.
Ben Steinbauer is the director of the documentary film The Winnebago Man. Jack Rebney is known as the angriest man in the world, a.k.a. The Winnebago Man. And Strange Chimp spoke with him. Here's a little more of that now infamous YouTube clip.
Why don't I say it f***ing right? What does the damn line say, Tony? What is the damn line? I don't give a what the line is. I f***ed up the word rear. I can't even read the f***ing B.O. straight. What the was that?
We got flies all over the place.
Son of a... Get out of here, you flies. There's a fly over the headlight, Tony. We got flies coming for us.
Get out of here, you flies.
We got three flies. Five flies. Get out of here, you...
Do you have an all-time favorite YouTube video you want to share? Just go to our Facebook page and post it so we can all see it. And yes, we posted the original Winnebago Man video there as well, uncensored. Later this hour, the first film ever shot and edited on an iPhone 4 and distributed as an app.
The first footage I ever shot with the iPhone was taking it and placing it on my father's model train and wedging it in with some foam into the back of a model train and letting it drive around the track for 5 minutes just to see what we would get.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Tasha Robinson, associate editor of the Onion's AV Club, says 2010 was the year of the documentary that wasn't. Catfish was a sensation that raised lingering questions about whether its surprises were planned in advance. Exit Through the Gift Shop was nominated for an Oscar, but it still isn't clear if it was a documentary. No matter what, 2010 was a great year for documentaries.
And then there's I'm Still Here, a film initially presented as a documentary about Joaquin Phoenix replacing his Oscar-nominated acting career with a marginal, struggling rap career. But from the moment Phoenix announced his career move in 2008, he was met with mixed apathy and doubt. The media repeatedly suggested he was putting them on. And Phoenix's occasional public appearances, mumbling and disheveled on David Letterman, or attacking a heckler after a terrible nightclub performance, suggested that if it wasn't a joke, it was an embarrassment. Either way, few people seemed to want to engage with the story. So when I'm Still Here director Casey Affleck, Phoenix's brother-in-law, revealed that the film was entirely fictional, the revelation seemed like a desperate attempt to grab the headlines that the film itself wasn't commanding. The ploy didn't work. Reviews were mixed, and the film was a box office flop. But in spite of that lackluster response, I'm Still Here deserves respect for its ambition. Phoenix and Affleck set out to push the limits of how fictional films are made. They wanted the public and the media to be complicit participants in their story, so they created real-world situations where Phoenix, in character, as an egotistical, emotionally damaged, drug-addled former film star, interacted with real people who took that character at face value. Phoenix maintained this character in public for a year and a half, shamelessly letting the entertainment world pillory him. While Affleck is uncomfortable with calling the project a hoax, it's hard not to see it as a straight-faced prank of Andy Kaufman proportions. And like Andy Kaufman, Phoenix and Affleck have seemed frustratingly reluctant to explain themselves. But explaining a joke is always awkward, and it always ruins the joke. And perhaps it's a mistake to interpret I'm Still Here as a joke at all. Because intentionally or no, what they've crafted is essentially an act of protective, preemptive celebrity therapy. I'm Still Here functions almost as a checklist of celebrity fears, from being judged talentless and unattractive, to being caught in bad behavior on tape, to being used and betrayed by their hangers-on. With I'm Still Here, Phoenix and Affleck don't just examine the anxieties of stardom. They actually expose themselves to them in a real-world environment, as if inoculating themselves. No wonder they're disappointed that instead of being impressed and engaged, the public has chosen to take I'm Still Here as a failed practical joke. But ultimately, the value of a piece of art isn't how it was made or what it was intended to do. It's how it stands on its own. And I'm Still Here stands as a remarkably harrowing and personal film, impeccably crafted to look like a documentary with the rawness of real emotion. And in the end, I'm Still Here is worth revisiting as the ambitious experiment it is, not as a false documentary or a filmed gag, but as a daringly vulnerable fiction. The story itself is nothing new. We've seen films about fading stars before, but never with this level of ugly, unvarnished realism, and never with this level of emotional risk and commitment. As curious as I'm Still Here's origin story is, it's a film that will benefit over time from its origin story being forgotten, leaving the results to stand on their own.
Tasha Robinson is an associate editor of the Onion's AV Club. The film I'm Still Here was directed by Casey Affleck and stars Joaquin Phoenix. During the 18 months of the making of this film, Phoenix and Affleck never let on that they were making a piece of fiction and not a documentary. Here's a now famous exchange between Joaquin Phoenix and rap mogul P. Diddy after Phoenix asks Diddy to be the producer of his rap album.
How you doing?
Good day, man. How's it going?
Good.
Joaquin Phoenix to see Diddy.
Is he who?
Diddy, Mr. Combs, Sean.
What's good?
What's up, man?
Obviously, you had great success in film and music, mm-hmm. and what I wanted is to be something.
Do you have money, though? Do you have money to do this?
Like, how much? I mean, I have a little studio, do you know? Like, in my garage, I got Pro Tools set up.
See, that's the mother problem. When people try to do things, they don't do it the way they do it for their own industries. When you go make a movie, you got money to make a movie, right?
What I want it to be is like a place of true exploration.
Can you do that in acting?
Well, I do. That's the thing is that as an actor, you're shielded. It's a different, you know, I mean, you know this, Christ.
No, that's not a different thing.
But you
lights, right?
Shit.
Lights, okay. Lights.
Yes, how much?
Craft services.
Yeah, it costs a lot.
Trailers.
Yeah.
Makeup, hair, DP.
Good point.
Gaffers.
I get it.
Same thing. Studio, engineer.
I got it.
Me.
Well.
Me.
Yeah, you.
The speakers.
I get it.
Do you have any money?
Well, how much you need?
How much you got?
Go ahead, let it out. Check it out, stretch it out.
Go ahead, let it out.
Here's a clip from the spy thriller Goldilocks.
Hello, Goldilocks. Wow, look at you. I've missed you. Everything's gonna be all right. Just relax. Just relax. It doesn't be this way. It really doesn't. I've forgiven you. Absolutely and completely forgiven you. All I want is what is rightfully mine.
It doesn't belong to you. And you know it.
You are just like your grandfather. How did such great potential go to waste? Here. Come on. I only hope that your son doesn't turn out to be as big a disappointment.
Hey! Will you stop hitting her?
That's a clip from the film series Goldilocks, shot entirely on an iPhone 4 and distributed as an app, which has never been done before. The film series is causing a sensation. The New York Times calls Goldilocks a sign of things to come, and the San Francisco Chronicle says the film is pushing limits. I caught up with Goldilocks filmmakers Michael Corbell and Anna Elizabeth James to find out where they got the idea for making an iPhone film.
I actually had my iPhone stolen, so Michael got online and ordered me a new iPhone 4, and 2 days before they were supposed to come out, we got to talking and we realized, oh my goodness, this phone has HD. We should see what we can do, like what kind of film we can make.
So does this change the way you budget for a film like this, for a project like this?
Absolutely. You know, Michael and I are still in school. We're graduate students at USC, and we spend a tremendous amount of money on tuition. And you're constantly trying to find ways to tell your story in a cost-effective manner. There's a couple of things that are so unique about shooting with your iPhone. One is you can be in a public place, and people don't know you're shooting. I mean, you could be taking a picture. It doesn't, you don't stand out of the crowd. All of our tools and equipment we have in this thing what we call a magic box, and it literally is filmmaking to go.
Can you give me some idea of what you had to budget for Goldilocks?
The whole budget for Goldilocks for 10 episodes was $2,500. And wow. If you do the math on that, shooting over 21, 22 days, that basically is taking care of food and basic rentals. We were very, very fortunate to have a huge team. I mean, there's probably over 50, 60, 70 people involved in Goldilocks when you count actors and crew that have just generously donated their time because they believe in changing the scape of filmmaking technology. And that's what we're trying to do. So
we should talk a little bit about the way that you're getting this scene, too. You distributed as an app on iPhones.
Yes, that idea originated from Michael and I went to go see a movie and we missed the trailers. So after the movie, I decided to look up the trailers. And it was this moment where we both looked at each other because I said, these trailers are kind of like short films. And it just came to us like, why hasn't anyone distributed their content through an app? Why, like, is there something wrong with this? Is this not allowed? And at that time, we had written the spec script of Goldilocks, and it was just a no-brainer for us. We thought, you know what? Let's try it. Let's see if we can create something and then distribute it ourselves.
So how does it work? You have the app, and you invite people to download it, and I guess it's word of mouth, pretty much, that gets that out. But how does it work once it begins? How do you let people know that there's another episode?
Well, one of the things that's really unique that Apple's designed into apps is push notifications. And so what we do is a lot of people use push notifications to say, you know, hey, download the new update, or you know, this bug fixed or whatever. We look at it as an opportunity to individually, essentially text message all of our end users around the world and say, hey, episode 8 is now online. Watch it in the Magic app. Essentially, we are using their, I guess you would say almost their maintenance notification system to make people aware that we have made a new project.
Well, I confess I've watched 8 episodes, which is, I guess, all you have out there. And I'm waiting for my push notification for number 9, but you're not going to tell me what it is, are you?
No. Well, your push notification will probably come out actually, it'll be very, very soon. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
You promise.
Just be ready because, yeah, it's going to be...
It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be amazing.
Of course it is. Now, there are upsides and downsides to this, I would think. The iPhone 4 does do HD, as you say, and it is a pretty flexible tool. But it is an iPhone, and it has to lack some tools that are available when you have fancier equipment, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I will say this, though. I've never shot with another camera that I can get a phone call on, though.
Did you have to alter the story because of technical limitations?
We actually altered the story with the utilization of the tool, basically coming up with story points where only the camera and the phone could go. Like, you know, in the first episode, we have the iPhone in a wine glass and we have it in a medicine cabinet. And that was really, really fun to challenge ourselves with the use of the actual small lens and what we could do with that lens.
Yeah, I remember the night that Annie and I knew for a fact we were going to shoot this on an iPhone, and we pulled out a piece of paper and we said, where would we always want to put a camera that we've never been able to before? And literally over the course of Goldilocks, we are checking off every single one of the things on that list. And I will say one of those things on the list, spoiler alert, is mounting it to a helicopter.
Oh. Now I really have to watch episode 9.
Yes.
I feel as though Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland are going to leap out of the background here and say, let's make a show.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
It would be.
So what's next after Goldilocks is done? You sound as though you're almost there.
We're almost there. Oh, my goodness. It's been amazing. We've learned so much, but we are definitely ready for the next thing.
Yeah, Michael and I, we created a company called Magic Pictures. And with Magic Pictures, we want to be the forerunners in what we consider the new way of storytelling, which is transmedia storytelling, where you come up with stories that are so compelling as a viewer or audience member, you want to read the book, play the game, and get as much involved with your characters as possible. So that's on our horizon.
Filmmakers Michael Corbell and Anna Elizabeth James talking about Goldilocks, a film series entirely made on an iPhone and distributed as an app. You can watch the entire series on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling a radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Pushing the Limits in Film, program number 320B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Ann Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.